drop down will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. It is Saturday, July 1st, in the glorious future year of 2023. Happy Canada Day to all my Canadian listeners. I'd say I hope to see you all in Winnipeg at PemiCon, July 20th through 23rd, but I know in practice that I won't. Canada is a big country with long distances which seem to intimidate Canadians themselves. People in British Columbia and people in Ontario and Quebec genuinely seem not to believe that they're in the same country. And as for the Prairie provinces and the Maritime provinces, people in BC and people in Ontario and Quebec have largely joined forces to totally ignore their existence. You will never hear of someone going from Toronto to Regina, Saskatchewan. They simply don't do it. As far as they're concerned, those places do not exist. Pardon me. Now, what do we have to talk about today? So, congratulations to Virgin Galactic on flying their first revenue flight with people. I know there are people out there now making invidious comparisons with the Titan submersible, and so I thought I'd like to point out a couple of places where these things are very different. Number one, the creator of the Titan submersible, well, we have extant correspondence from him saying, in pretty much in so many words, "Well, I'm just sick and tired of you qualified naval architects telling me that my design is defective and my submersible is going to kill somebody. You're just jealous. You're very hidebound, and you're just jealous of my innovative engineering. Yeah, right. The people at Virgin Galactic, to be very honest, do not have to be told that what they're doing is likely to kill somebody if they do anything at all wrong, because it's already happened. They have had, in the course of 20 years of development almost, you know, the Ansari X Prize was won in 2004, work on Spaceship Two began immediately. In fact, you could say that it had been going on already. And they had a deadly accident in 2009. Some folks in one of the ground crews were killed in a fairly stupid kind of testing accident involving their nitrous oxide propellant. They use it as an oxidizer. It's an oxidizing monopropellant, so it decomposes, releasing energy, and that decomposition also releases oxygen, which is then used to burn the propellant grain. Anyway, then they had a deadly flight accident, the most remarkable thing about which was the vehicle broke up in midair at high altitude and high velocity, and one of the two crewmen actually survived. But yeah, Virgin Galactic, the folks at the spaceship company, they don't need to be told that what they're doing could kill somebody because it already has. So, the idea of that kind of false confidence, it's not going to be found. Now, Another very important difference is that the Titan submersible was basically built just for kicks. It was built to take very wealthy people down to goggle at the wreck site of the Titanic, not to do anything particularly useful. Now, the private space industry is on a very different basis, although it may not be immediately obvious. You say, oh, well, you're just taking very rich people up into space for a few minutes, you know, up above the sensible atmosphere, you know, giving them a few minutes of weightlessness, you know, for $500,000, Jesus Christ. Well, of course, that's the initial price, right? After 200 flights at $500,000 apiece, they might lower the price considerably. They might have gained enough operating experience to completely redesign the vehicle, right? Which they could do for 200 times $500,000. $100 million is nothing to sneeze at, right? But the point of the Titan submersible was just to continue being itself, essentially. It had no real point in advancing the state of the art for deep sea diving and operations. Because as it turns out, deep sea diving and operations is a pretty well-established field. There's a lot of activity in it. You know, the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute's submersible Alvin has made literally thousands of dives in 60-plus years of operation. It's one of its earliest uses being to recover thermonuclear bombs off the coast of Spain, where a nasty accident of the U.S. Air Force had left them. But the Alvin submersible has made thousands of dives in the course of 60 years. There are lots of at least semi-routine operations at considerable depth in the oil industry in particular. Near space operations isn't really like that. In terms of stuff that you can launch, land, turn around and launch again immediately, right? Fly, land, turn around and fly again immediately. I mean, the X-15 is just about it. And the X-15 was extremely expensive, carried one person in very cramped accommodations, and did have a deadly accident, killed poor Scott Crossfield. He managed to pull out of a flat spin at Mach 6, and no one knows in the world how he did it, because half a minute later, the control systems on the aircraft malfunctioned and flew him into the ground, and there was nothing he could do about it. No one has ever had the opportunity to question the only pilot who's ever pulled out of a hypersonic flat spin, which is believed to be impossible. But the important thing here is that no matter who's providing the money for it, the people working in the field of space tourism have a very well-defined objective. Their objective is that they want to improve the technology of spaceflight to make space travel more routine and more accessible. And you do that by doing the same thing over and over and over again, a whole lot of times very frequently. You know, the same way as with airline operations. There are huge numbers of airline flights a year, huge numbers, in fact, every day. And it's done by having aircraft that you can land, refuel, and take off again. And don't have to be completely refurbished the way the space shuttle had to be. Right, don't have to be completely rebuilt. You don't have to build a complete new one every time, right? The space tourism has always been about getting the funding to do all the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of flights with dozens of vehicles that you have to do in order to get the information and experience you need in order to build things that will fly to orbit cheaply and frequently. The whole point of space tourism is it gives you a revenue stream, right? It means that every flight, instead of burning up money, is producing money, which you can plow back into the development program. And it means that when you have a revenue stream, you can attract investors. Of course, we see in the capital markets today the so-called phenomenon of tech, in which you don't have to have a revenue stream to attract investors. You just have to say, well, sometime in the future, there'll be revenue from this. And people say, oh yeah, I want to plow money into it. Let me put in some money. Ultimately, the tourism part of space tourism is an excuse to fly the vehicle over and over and over and over again until you get it completely right and can move on to the next vehicle. And the tourism also means that you've paid for the next vehicle by the time it comes to build it. That's what it's all about. Now, another important factor that's perhaps not immediately obvious is that wealthy sightseers aren't the only people involved with space tourism. The fact is that space tourism vehicles, there's lots of scientific experiments that need a few minutes of weightlessness and then need to be tinkered with for a few hours or days or weeks and flown again in a few minutes of weightlessness. They don't need to wait months to years to go up to the ISS, remain on the ISS months to years, and come down again. They need to be able to be iterated, right? And the suborbital tourism vehicles have, from the beginning, have planned to meet this market. And NASA and various academic organizations, governmental and non-governmental scientific bodies, and businesses which have an interest in this kind of research have, from the beginning, planned to use these suborbital vehicles in this way. And of course, one aspect of that is that it means much more scrutiny. Because frankly, rich people frequently feel as though they're indestructible. Nothing bad has ever happened to them, so nothing bad ever will happen to them. On the other hand, if you're going to set up a scientific experiment, you're going to insist on having adequate information to make you believe that the experiment and possibly experimenter you're sending up with it, that what you expect to happen is going to happen. And so there's another layer of scrutiny. There are more eyes on the problem, as someone might say. So the comparison between the Titan submersible and the Spaceship Two is, I think, very far from exact. Now, speaking of space and speaking of Canada, I note that there's discussion of a new $5 currency note in Canada. You know, the old paper fives had the portrait of Wilfrid Laurier, a famous figure in Canadian political history, and the portrait was such that people, many people, to the extent that the Bank of Canada sent around circulars asking people please not to do this, but many people, with a little pen and ink, altered it to be Mr. Spock from Star Trek. Now, some years back, they changed the $5 currency note. They introduced a polymer composition, and they changed the design to a more facing portrait, which is very difficult to alter into Mr. Spock. Not that people don't occasionally try still, but it's much more difficult. But on the backside of the note, they included a number of space achievement motifs, and I have a video about that on my TubeNix. Let me see if I can drop in a link. TubeNix, yes. Down here somewhere. Canadian Space Money, yes. Copy link. Let's see if that works. I'm going to dump it into the metadata and see if it goes through. Anyhow. But, so, allegedly, the $5 note is going to be redesigned. And there's been a list of candidates put forward, most of whom are First Nations people, some of whom are women. The best known, perhaps most popular choice seems to be the runner, Terry Fox. Anyway, I have strong suspicion that the back of the new $5 note is not going to have space motifs. It's not going to have the Canada arm, right, that kind of thing. And personally, I think that's very unfortunate. I think that they ought to have a currency note which celebrates Canadian achievements in space. I think that they ought to have maybe Chris Hadfield on a currency note. Doesn't have to be the five, but the five is the note that has the space motifs currently. you know, I'm really all in favor of having this. I mean, the U.S. dollar coin, in my opinion, should still use the Apollo 11 design that was used on the Eisenhower dollar and the Anthony dollar. Instead, we've got these just ghastly. They're not even being released for circulation because people don't care about them. Which, you know, that's another conversation entirely, eliminating the dollar currency note. I have a whole coinage reform that I would propose, because I really think the current coinage of the U.S. doesn't meet the needs very well. I mean, firstly, when the clad quarter was introduced, right, it bought more of most of the necessities of life than a paper dollar buys today. Considerably more in some cases. Now, of course, the reason the U.S. has a quarter dollar has to do with the old Spanish colonial silver coins, which circulated freely in the United States until 1858. Spanish and Mexican silver, two reales piece. A real being known to many English speakers as a bit, and you've probably heard, shave and a haircut, 2 bits. Well, any place in the USA nowadays, a shave and a haircut is going to cost at least $25. People don't have 100 times as much hair as they had in 1858. Now, it's not all currency depreciation, obviously. For one thing, barbershops are usually air-conditioned now, which wasn't even possible in 1858. You know, you can't even assign a cost to that. But really, it doesn't necessarily make sense to continue tying the U.S. coinage to a model that most people are totally unaware of and is absolutely irrelevant to anything in our modern lives. Really and honestly, the quarter dollar coin, which is probably the most widely used of the U.S. coin denominations, is the size it is because of the Spanish colonial two real piece, which was a trifle larger. Anyway, but the U.S. coin was made somewhat smaller to keep them from being exported, essentially. That's the quickest way I can describe it. But, you know, so yes, I have a whole plan which involves eliminating the $1 and $2 currency notes, eliminating the cent denomination entirely, having the smallest coin be a half dime, that's an old denomination, then a half dime, a dime, a 2-dime coin, a half dollar coin, a dollar coin, and a $2 coin, and then 5, 10, and 20 or dollar or half eagle, eagle, and double eagle coins, mostly non-circulating. In other words, they would be commemoratives. Instead of changing the design of the quarter 5 times a year, which they've been doing, which is idiocy, the 5, 10, and 20 dollar coins, or half eagle, eagle, and double eagle, would have a commemorative motif. Each one would have a motif for the year, and they'd change annually. And these would not mostly be non-circulating coins. In other words, you could circulate them, but I don't expect them to circulate widely. Although I could be right, I could be mistaken in that. The example of the Japanese 500 yen coin shows that it is possible for a high denomination coin to circulate in a modern economy. I mean, basically, it's a question of, do you want a lot of credit card accepting vending machines? Do you want a push towards a, quote, cashless society, unquote? I don't think those are particularly good things. But there are some very powerful, right, some very powerful lobbies in favor of the cashless society, in favor of pay with your phone at this vending machine, and all those other things. In my opinion, having every possible transaction, no matter how small, pass through the hands of financial services middlemen is a recipe for problems. Because, I mean, 2008 certainly brought it up very hard to a lot of people that the financial services companies, some of which are banks, some of which are not banks, can become insolvent. They can stop paying. They can stop accepting payments. They can lock up your payments. And then what? Right? So given a choice between that, and on the other hand, the difficulties the Japanese are having with counterfeiting of the 500 yen coin, I think there's a case to be made for the 500 yen coin. But as I say, I think that the, Canadian $2 coin is very successful. The Australian and New Zealand $2 coins are very successful. The 2 euro coin is very successful. I think that we can reasonably eliminate the $1 and $2 paper notes and have a conversation about the five. Anyway, so other things of note that are going on. The turmoil in Russia, nobody really wants. I don't think anyone seriously considered, but anyone who would consider it for a moment would observe that nobody really wants a civil war in a country with tens of thousands of hydrogen bombs. You don't want any kind of political turmoil in a country with tens of thousands of hydrogen bombs. Now, my own personal opinion is, I don't want a country with tens of thousands of hydrogen bombs. I've said it before and I've said it again. I think concern about nuclear proliferation is somewhat misplaced because I believe the world would be far safer if you had 200 countries, each with 5 atom bombs, than 2 countries, each with 5,000, 10,000, 15,000 atom bombs. I mean, the obvious problem, if you have a world in which there are 200 countries, each with 5 atom bombs, is that there's a decent chance, in the course of a decade, that a bomb or two will get dropped. And that's horrible, right? It's awful to contemplate. On the other hand, we can be pretty sure that our civilization could survive 1 or 2 atomic bombs being dropped in the course of a decade. It's almost certain that our civilization could not survive 10,000 atomic bombs being dropped in the course of 10 days, or potentially 10 hours. So, I guess the question then becomes, what's worse than a war between Russia and Ukraine, which could potentially pull in European powers, some of whom have nuclear weapons? And the answer is a complete breakdown of civil order inside Russia. I don't know what to say. I am not in favor of authoritarianism, and I'm not saying that making sure Putin stays in power no matter what is the solution. I think that that's just, at best, delaying matters for a while. Ultimately, you would prefer that the Russians take it into their heads that authoritarianism is not the great thing that they've always behaved as it is. You'd hope that there's some kind of nuclear disarmament. You'd hope, well, for sanity and goodwill to reign around the world. Man, that's the thing I would hope for. Maybe it's a bit far-fetched, but what can you do, right? What can you hope for? What can I do or write against the fall of night? But, I don't know. I mean, this is one reason why I like to emphasize the peaceful and constructive uses of nuclear energy, because I think the more people focus on those, the more incentive there is to put those resources of nuclear fuel and such to work. Right? Put them to work. put the expertise to work doing things that are good for people and the world as a whole. What more could one want? What more could one ask for? And of course, the question of governance systems and so on leads me to consider there's been a lot of uproar after the decisions the United States Supreme Court issued to close out its term. A lot of people saying these are horrible decisions and we need to do something about the whole system that makes them possible. We need to do something about the Supreme Court. And then I'm looking at Poland and I'm looking at Israel. And here's the thing. It's like everybody says we want an independent judiciary as long as the independent judiciary is making decisions they approve of. And then when the independent judiciary isn't making decisions they approve of, well, they say, oh, we don't want an independent judiciary. Well, we want a judiciary that's responsible, that's answerable to someone. You know, and the problem is, obviously, that a judiciary can be answerable to you and the things you think are right, the values you hold, or it can be answerable to someone who is exactly the opposite opinion. This is not an easy problem. Judicial independence certainly allows some bad outcomes, but lack of judicial independence clearly allows even worse outcomes. How do you balance these interests, right? How do you adjust for these problems? This is not a trivial question. I don't think anybody anywhere has ever come up with a really good solution. I'm posing the problem for you to think about, not because I think I have an answer for it. Goodness gracious me, no. But it also makes me think about representative government as a whole. You know, it's fairly obvious that legislators have very limited competency. Yet they don't know about all the things that they have to come up with legislation about. And this is clearly a problem. Ministers in governments often are not anything like experts on the subjects that they're nominally in charge of. And this is a problem. Now, how do we defeat these problems? Among other things, of course, because I want a political system in space settlements that's a little more stable than the ones here on Earth, is a little less likely to do self-destructive things, because in a space colony, you really could just let all the air out. That's not good, okay? People, not good at all. But there's no easy solution. You know, in the state of Texas, where I live, where I am right now, the Constitution is written so that the various functions of the state are not all handled by one executive, by one legislature. The fact is that oil and gas regulation, for example, although the legislature has a thumb in the pie, is mostly handled by something called the Railroad Commission, which is elected separately. Thing is, most people voting for Railroad Commission don't have any real understanding of what it does or how it does it. You know, and who runs for election to the Railroad Commission? Well, you get petroleum engineers, who at least know something about the subject, but their field of vision is narrow, perhaps. You have petroleum lawyers, who are same result remarks but twice as bad, and you have the so-called consumer advocates and environmentalists, most of whom care very deeply about these subjects, but not enough to actually learn anything about them. So the voters are fairly useless, and the people they elect are often kind of useless. So that's not a solution either. But this is not the solution. This is not the show where I give you pat solutions to all the world's problems. This is a show where I suggest questions and possible lines of attack. And it's called A Step Farther Out, and it airs every Saturday at 1900 UTC on anonradio.net, just before the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe. Send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America.